A Race for Glory. No one knew better than Tom Durant that the grading work that lay ahead in Utah's hilly and rocky terrain would be difficult and time-consuming. And for the first time, UP crews would have no choice but to construct tunnels in the most challenging areas. If the UP was to win the race across Utah, it had to hire a large number of new workers. And Durant knew just where to find this army of laborers. There were some 80,000 members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, better known as Mormons, living in Utah. Led by a charismatic man named Brigham Young, the Mormons were known for being hard workers, just the type of people that Durant so badly needed. The Mormons were a deeply religious people with a unique history. Because they held beliefs that were very different from other religions, they had from their beginnings suffered both discrimination and persecution. Seeking to find a place where they could practice their religion in peace, they had followed their leader, Joseph Smith, first from New York to Ohio, then to Missouri, then to Illinois, where Smith was killed by a prejudiced mob. Their new leader was a man named Brigham Young, and in the mid-1840s, determined to find a place so remote that he and his fellow Mormons could escape persecution, he led them on a 1,000-mile trek all the way through the Utah Territory wilderness, where they finally settled in a desert next to the Great Salt Lake. Because it was so dry and so seemingly unsuitable for farming, it was a place where no one else wanted to live. But the Mormons irrigated the dry land with water from creeks and streams, planted crops, and flourished. By 1860, the original Mormon pioneers had been joined by more than 40,000 other believers, and more than 150 settlements had been established. All of this took place under the watchful eye of Brigham Young. He was a great leader, and having experienced firsthand how difficult it was to travel across the United States, he was a great champion of a transcontinental railroad, particularly one that would carry passengers through the treacherous landscape that he and his early followers had traveled on their way into Utah. "We never went through the canyons or worked our way over the dividing ridges," he wrote, "without asking where the rails could be laid." Young and those who had followed him into Utah would receive credit for having blazed the route into that territory. As reporter Samuel Bowles wrote once the Great Iron Road had been completed, "But for the pioneership of the Mormons, all this central region of our Great West would now be many years behind in its development, and the railroad, instead of being finished, would hardly be begun." Blazing the way through the challenging Utah landscape was an invaluable contribution, and the Mormons' importance in making the Transcontinental Railroad a reality would grow even greater once they went to work for both the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific. On May 6, 1868, Durant sent a telegram to Brigham Young asking him if he could supply a large number of men to work on the UP's construction project. In less than an hour, he got a telegram back from Young stating that he was willing to do so. If Durant had known what was happening within the Mormon settlements, he would not have been surprised at Young's quick, positive response. During the past two growing seasons, the Mormon communities had been struck by a devastating plague of grasshoppers. The insects had destroyed so many of the Mormons' crops that thousands of their men were out of work and in desperate need of money. Immediately after receiving Young's welcome reply, Durant sent one of his engineers, who knew the Mormon leader personally, to work out a contract with him. When it was signed, it provided that Young would supply 4,000 workers whose main tasks would be grading, tunneling, and bridge building. As part of the agreement, the UP promised that from that time on, Mormons, particularly those immigrating to their settlements, would be allowed to travel on Union Pacific trains at lowered rates. Durant had found the additional workers he needed, and he had received a bonus, for in addition to significantly increasing the size of the UP workforce, the Mormon laborers proved to be among the most hard-working and dedicated he had ever seen. And unlike so many of the other UP workers, the Mormons, who weren't allowed to smoke, drink, or gamble, had absolutely no inclination to spend time in any hell-on-wheels towns that might spring up along the way. Gratified to at last be earning money again, many of the Mormons actually sang as they went about their labors. A particular favorite was, "We surely live in a very fast age. We've traveled by ox team and then took the stage. But when such conveyance is all done away, we'll travel in steam cars upon the railway. Hurrah, hurrah, for the railroad's begun. 3 cheers for our contractor, his name's Brigham Young. Hurrah, hurrah, we're honest and true, for if we stick to it, it's bound to go through." Stick to it they did. By the time the work on the Utah roadbed was completed, one historian would write, "It was acknowledged by all railroad men that nowhere on the line could the grading compare in completeness and finish with the work done by the people of Utah." He meant the Mormons. Not everyone was happy with what the Mormons were contributing to the UP's efforts. The Central Pacific's directors viewed their rivals' new not-so-secret weapon in the Great Race with alarm. There was only one solution. The CP had to get its own army of Mormon workers to combat what those working for the UP were accomplishing. No one was more determined to make this happen than CP President Leland Stanford. Traveling first by rail and then by stagecoach, Stanford made his way to Salt Lake City, where he convinced Brigham Young to supply the CP with enough workers to grade roadbeds from the Nevada border to Utah's Weber Canyon. When Young agreed, the industrious Mormons were working for both the CP and the UP. With the hiring of the Mormon workers, both companies had successfully addressed the manpower problems they faced in Utah. But there was another long-standing issue that simply would not go away. It was the extraordinary challenge of getting millions of tons of building materials and equipment to the construction sites. In 1869, at the same time that CP track layers were beginning to set their first rails on Utah soil, no fewer than 35 ships carrying rails, spikes, and other supplies that would be needed in Utah were at sea, headed for San Francisco. The equipment would then travel by train to Strobridge's crews. Included in the precious cargo were 18 locomotives. Marveling at the situation, the Salt Lake Daily Reporter exclaimed, "There is not a rail on the CP line of the road that has not been brought a distance of 6,000 miles. At the same time, the UP crews were met in Utah by the heaviest snows they had encountered since those that had battered them back on the plains more than a year ago. But this time there would be no halting. Neither Durant nor Casement would allow it. Instead, promising the men double wages, they had them break up the frozen earth with pickaxes and blasting power, and drag ties and rails out of snowbanks. It was exhausting work, made even more daunting when, for the next 100 miles of track laying, temperatures continued to hover at 0 degrees or below. No one was prouder of the westward progress than Grenville Dodge. We laid the track over the Wasatch Range, in Utah's Promontory Mountains, in the dead of winter on top of snow and ice," he wrote. "We built almost as rapidly through the winter as we did during the summer." Meanwhile, despite the snow, Strobridge was driving his crews eastward just as hard. "Keep right on laying rails just as though you did not care for the snow," Huntington had begged him. "And if you do that, I will forever pray that you will have your reward." Now the Central Pacific was also approaching the Promontory Range. Only 50 miles separated the two great rivals. Wires above the tracks. The Pacific Railway Act of 1862 was more than an act to build a transcontinental railroad. It was, as officially stated, an act to aid in the construction of a railroad and telegraph line from the Missouri River to the Pacific Ocean. The act also specifically stated that the telegraph lines were to keep up with tracks every step of the way across the continent. And the men who made up the telegraph work gangs were determined to see that that happened. So much so that an intense rivalry developed between the telegraph gangs and the track gangs. Like the laying of the rails, the erection of some 2,000 miles of telegraph poles and wires was done with military precision. At the same time that wagons distributed rails along the graded earth, other wagons brought telegraph poles to the graded site. While the poles lay on the ground, one telegraph gang nailed cross arms onto them while another dug holes for the poles. Then a third telegraph gang erected the poles. Once this was completed, a wagon carrying a huge reel of wire appeared. As the wagon moved forward, the wire was uncoiled, allowing a wire gang to carry it up the pole and attach it to the insulators. It was a precise operation, but not without its challenges. As one reporter observed, at times, lack of wagons made it impossible to keep up the supply of poles, and the telegraph gangs, who pride themselves on never letting the track get ahead of them, utilize sagebrush, barrels, ties, surreptitiously taken from the track, or anything else that would keep the wire off the ground until the supply of poles again equal the demand. Throughout the erection of the transcontinental telegraph line, operations were interrupted by Native Americans who cut the line not only to interrupt the telegraph crew's progress, but to get at the shiny copper wire that they found perfect for making jewelry. An even greater challenge came from another source. As historian John Hoyt Williams wrote, even a few dozen buffalo could damage track, and later, thousands of telegraph poles would go crashing to the ground as the heavy beasts of the treeless plains discovered they made marvelous scratching posts. Just as the building of the Transcontinental Railroad revolutionized transportation in America, the erection of a cross-country telegraph line provided the United States with the greatest long-distance communication system it had ever had. And the telegraph was essential to the building of the Great Road itself. The construction trains of both the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific contained a telegraph car in which Jack Casement or James Strobridge or their engineers or foremen could wire for new supplies or for new groups of workers. And as the UP moved farther and farther from its home base in Omaha and the Central Pacific moved farther from its headquarters in Sacramento, it would be the telegraph that allowed both Strobridge and Casement to end each day by reporting on what progress had been made. Although the Pacific Railway Act of 1862 had authorized both companies to build the Iron Road, it made no mention of where the tracks were to be joined. Picking such a site was a decision that the leaders of both companies kept avoiding. They were getting paid by the mile, and by 1869 it was apparent that despite the great race in which they were involved, both would have been content to keep laying track forever. As the two lines got closer and closer to each other, their grading crews began constructing parallel roadbeds that ran for miles past each other. Also, the directors of both the CP and the UP had become masters at finding different ways to siphon money from the company's treasuries into their own bank accounts. No wonder they didn't want construction to end. Finally, the government had had enough. On March 4, 1869, the same day that he was sworn in as president, Ulysses S. Grant issued a stern warning to both companies. If they didn't get together and agree on the spot where the rails would be linked, the government would stop paying them until they did.